This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Well, hello. Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and it is Wednesday, July 22nd, 2020. This is the 258th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a chef and restaurateur who's rowing a few boats at once, and I will introduce her fully in a moment. First, as I do in every show, I will start out with my PR tip, and then later we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to be an activist. Yes, fight for what you believe, for your truth, and for the changes you want to see in the world. We all can and should speak up and advocate for causes that resonate with us, and use our platforms to bring awareness and attention for what we feel is right. We can be advocates for change and strive to implement new policies and laws for the better good. So let's remember to use our voices to help make a difference and get active. That's my tip today. Now, I'm very thrilled to be joined today by Camilla Marcus. She is the chef and founder of Westbourne, the popular all-day zero-waste restaurant in Soho, Manhattan, that operates with a unique, fully integrated, philanthropic business model. Camilla is a co-founder of Relief Opportunities for All Restaurants, otherwise known as ROAR, an organization working to enact a sustainable future for the restaurant industry in New York. She is also a founding member of the Independent Restaurant Coalition, formerly the Director of Business Development for Union Square Hospitality Group. Camilla has worked in real estate investing, and she trained in both business and law at the Wharton School and NYU, and earned a culinary degree from the International Culinary Center. And without further ado, welcome to the show. Hi, Camilla. Hi, thanks so much for joining me. I read off a summary of your bio, a short bio, because you've accomplished a lot and your background and everything you've done is really impressive. So I always love to start out with my guests and find out, you know, how they got into the culinary industry and a little bit about your background. I know you grew up in LA, so you want to tell us a little bit about what that was like?
Yeah, and thank you again for having me. So delighted. So I'm born and raised in Los Angeles, sort of one of the rare second generation locals. My mom's also from Los Angeles, born and raised, and found my way, you know, to the East Coast. I went to college in Philadelphia, and I think since a young age, really just had a deep passion for food. I always loved to cook. You know, no one in my family really is into food the way that I am. My mom tells interesting stories about my grandfather, who was actually a heart surgeon and heart researcher. So I like to think I sort of get it from him, but always knew I wanted to go to culinary school. I loved to cook, and I thought, you know, it just would be so amazing to learn really how to do it. And really fell in love with restaurants, again, from a very young age, and sort of found my people there. So culinary school is really the first step, and it just felt so fulfilling. I loved the intensity. I love, you know, it's such an intense operating business and so complicated and intellectually stimulating, but also obviously so creative and artistic. And I love design and taking care of others and sort of putting this whole wild puzzle together to create special experiences for others. I loved in culinary school. I mean, we had people from 25 different countries, all different ages, and it just felt like this really beautiful melting pot. You know, and every day you're really learning something new and having to stretch and challenge yourself. And You know, I think that, that sense of sort of adventure every day was something that, that really fit. So I sort of navigated the industry from there. I worked at an internship before, so at the same time as culinary school, at Del Anima, which is no longer open, but was a very special place, my first restaurant home, with Joe Campanale and August Cardona. And really, again, that sort of sparked that, you know, I wasn't sure exactly where I would go in the industry and what part of it I would be. I really had such a deep interest in all of it. But I knew it would be the industry I'd want to be in long term, and just kind of had to navigate through it.
Yeah, I don't know if you know this about me, but I lived in Chicago before New York, and I went to a small cooking school called the Cooking Academy of Chicago, and I loved the hands-on experience, and I thought at the time I wanted to be a chef. I wasn't exactly sure, you know, where I was going to end up, but I love that I obviously now got into restaurant PR and doing other things. But I love that I had that experience, and there was something about it that was so special when you're describing it that I totally get. So what then, I mean, and Del Anima, I was such a fan of that restaurant as well. What led you then to Union Square Hospitality Group?
So I ended up graduating from culinary school and going to NYU to get a JD MBA. You know, it's somewhat parallel to what's happening right now. I mean, after that year was when the last financial crisis hit, and, you know, it was impossible to get a job. Most of my friends were out of work, and, you know, we were pretty fresh out of college with no experience, so not exactly easy to get employment. So I thought, to some extent, hiding out in graduate school while things sort of sorted. And during that time, worked with Tom Colicchio on developing River Park, which is on the east side in New York, and then ended up moving back to Los Angeles, where I was from, for a short period after grad school to work for a real estate private equity fund that actually had quite an extensive retail, food and beverage, and hotel portfolio. So I ended up managing most of their investments and acquisitions in that space, obviously given sort of my brief operating background. And then ended up coming back to New York to be head of business development for Danny Meyer and Union Square Hospitality Group at a really pivotal time. I mean, they had an entirely new C-suite of executives. Shake Shack was in the process of going public. And, you know, they had 5 chef transitions, 5 openings. I mean, it was really a transformative year. It was their 30th anniversary, so a real transformative pivotal year in the company's history. Learned a ton, and, you know, then left shortly thereafter to start my own company. And I think, you know, each experience was vastly different and helped me really learn full scope about the industry from so many different angles. I always say pretty much the only job I've never had in the restaurant business is a server. I'm very clumsy. I have done catering back in the day, and my boss at that time can tell you I am great with people. I am horrible at carrying multiple things at once. So I think, you know, for me, I really believe in the virtue of a generalist. I believe so much in education, training, and development when it comes to our industry. I think so many people have interest in so many different parts of the industry, and, you know, I think the future will be much more cross-training, much more fluidity, and sort of less hierarchy. And, you know, I think I sort of crafted my career, I don't think intentionally, but looking back, sort of to get as broad of a base of experience as I could.
Yeah, absolutely. So when did you first think, or when did Wes born the idea of it, the concept, like, when did you first start working on that? And because I have a feeling it was something that you were, you know, thinking about for a while before maybe you officially launched it. And because you have such a unique, not just menu and style, but like your whole philosophy, everything you're doing is unique to it and amazing. So when was Westbourne born?
So, yeah, I mean, the idea really started, I think the kernel of the idea started when I was working with Danny and the company, you know, just seeing sort of the dynamics of, frankly, society and my generation change. You know, philanthropy is seen so differently. It's not saving up until the end of life to, you know, potentially put your name on a building or these sort of big acts of kindness. I think my generation really wants to live our values every single day. And we believe in, you know, compound impact, I like to say, sort of like compound interest in investing. You know, a little bit every day actually goes more of a long way than these sort of big, big splashy investments. And started thinking a lot about that and realizing, you know, our industry is incredibly generous. We donate so much of our time, our goods, our efforts. We care about our communities and we invest so much in that. But it always felt disconnected from guests. You know, Myelina raises a tremendous amount for cancer research. And, you know, most people don't know that. And, you know, each of our restaurants had such a big passion. And, you know, I don't think the guests who dined there really realized and were connected to it. So, you know, in parallel, seeing such a big movement in conscious capitalism with the rise of obviously Warby Parker and Tom's, you know, and even Everlane to some extent, really this rise of, I care about what I'm doing in my daily life. I care where I spend my money. I vote with my dollars. I live with my values and I want what I do in my daily routine to mean something more. And really realizing that no one in hospitality really put that stake in the ground. There wasn't a mission-driven hospitality company out there. And so the more I started to think about it, I had a close relationship with Robin Hood through, we used to do, and the company still, Union Square Events, the catering arm of the company still does the annual event. And I had worked it a couple times because I was just fascinated with the ability to serve 4,000 people at once. So I thought, you know, I've got to learn, put me to work. And I really got to know the Robin Hood organization out of that. And I really, the first, right when I left USHG, I met with Robin Hood first and I said, you know, I have this kind of crazy idea. You know, what if a portion of every single purchase, a glass of wine, a party, a catering event, you know, a bag of Chex Mix, you know, coffee, my lunch, my dinner, what if a portion of that every single time to be an all-day place where someone's going hopefully multiple times a week and it's really integrated in their lives, what if that contributed back to a neighborhood program that then fed back into our business? So I really sort of pitched it to them thinking they would laugh me out of the room. I mean, they're a massive organization. They are, you know, such a high impact, high performing, incredible organization. And honestly, I thought I'd be laughed out of the room. And every single one of them, you could see light bulbs go off. And they said, you're right. You know, think about how much people spend time and effort and energy in and around restaurants, right? You eat mostly three meals a day. And it's the thing you think about most and probably spend most of your income on. And what if a small portion of that could do good in our neighborhood and take care of our neighbors? So 1% of every purchase at Westbourne goes through the Robin Hood Foundation to a local organization called The Door. And we invest in hospitality retraining for youth in the neighborhood. And then we hire from that program. And so, you know, again, that idea was really, you know, a lot of these conscious capital brands that are tremendous, most give money abroad. And I felt very strongly that, you know, anyone who lives in New York and frankly, any neighborhood across the country, we all have help that's desperately needed in our own backyards. And so it was also critically important that it was locally integrated and, you know, with our neighbors.
Yeah, it's really wonderful that you set that up. And having been to Westbourne a few times, I mean, it's such a welcoming, beautiful space. And I guess we should talk a little bit about the food and the menu and what you do for people who don't know. I believe you've said in the past that it's accidentally vegetarian as part of your description, but it's the food is, I find it to be, it's delicious, but I also feel really good eating it. Like it's healthy. It's like there's a wellness component. At least that's what my experience has been.
Yeah, so we, you know, it was always our goal to be the first zero waste restaurant in Manhattan, which, you know, the irony being we received our certification, I think the week of the shutdown, very bittersweet. But our food philosophy really stemmed from that. Again, you know, if if the goal is to eat and drink well, but do even better, then obviously our food philosophy has to go along with that. So we always said accidentally vegetarian and decidedly wholesome, because the goal is not to be preachy, but, you know, all whole ingredients, well-sourced, you know, creativity and innovative on the culinary side, but also, you know, thinking about our carbon footprint and how, you know, how we eat obviously contributes to global warming and the environment that we're going to pass down to the next generation. So our goal is really just to be a place where you love to hang, you know, it's delicious, as you said, nourishing and exciting, but also, you know, is mindful of how it's sourced, how it gets on your plate, and, you know, the experience being as low impact to the environment as possible.
Yeah, I miss your food. and I mean, I want to dive into a bit of what's happening with the changes now with COVID. But before that, you also have been working with to change childcare in the hospitality industry. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a through line here, which is I guess I'm an inherent problem solver, and I just feel I always say I'm a forever optimist, and I think it's the optimism in me that feels that things can be better and that there's always something that can be done to improve, you know, improve our industry and improve our communities. So our partnership with Vivi, again, went live, you know, just months before the pandemic hit, and it really came out of right when we opened, a couple months in, we started realizing that your childcare was a huge barrier to retaining a number of really high-performing, high-potential employees that we had invested a lot in, and we just couldn't solve the problem on our own. I mean, we tried modified schedules temporarily, but, you know, at the end of the day, restaurants do not have the space or the wherewithal or the bandwidth, you know, to really be able to do on-site childcare. You know, running our four walls is hard enough as it is, as we're seeing particularly now. And, you know, childcare obviously is a highly regulated industry, as it should be. So, you know, we started doing a lot of deep research on what's possible with, you know, thinking of, so interesting because healthcare and career development has been a big focus of the last 10 years as far as, you know, workplace, you know, wellness and security and how you take care of your teams. And yet, I feel that childcare really hasn't been at the forefront, when really it's the gating issue, right? If you can't get to work, you can't keep your job, and therefore all of the other perks or benefits, frankly, are irrelevant. So it actually is interesting because it's the most important issue is how do you keep, you know, how do you keep parents able to do both? Because the choice of showing up to work or going to work and not being able to care or, you know, watch your child, there is no choice, right? That's a total impossibility. And when you look, you know, so many people talk about the why. One, it's the right thing to do. But two, hiring, training, onboarding new people is incredibly expensive. Multitudes more expensive than investing in great, amazing, high potential people that are already part of your team. And I think childcare is a big element of that. So we ended up scouring really the landscape all across New York, and lo and behold, no one offers anything that accommodates, you know, the unusual schedules of restaurant workers. And what we also uncovered was actually hospitals have a very similar dynamic. You know, they have shifts and they're not 9-to-5 jobs, and they work weekends just as we do, and they work holidays, and traditional childcare offerings in and around the city. One, most are cost prohibitive, especially in the city where people are coming in for their jobs. And two, you know, they're the ones that are affordable are far and don't offer extended hours. So, you know, we spoke to the Bright Horizons of the world, and that company specifically as well, who sort of said, you know, they're a very large corporation. They're making a ton of money, and they don't see a reason to change the model, even though they're ignoring essentially millions across the country who really desperately need this kind of assistance. So I ended up, through Tina Cowan, actually meeting someone at the city who said, oh, you know, we've been in touch with this startup that hasn't yet launched. It's called Vivi Early Learning, and they're essentially trying to transform childcare for my generation, for a new generation, through a more employer-sponsored program. So similar to the way health insurance works in this country, you get it through your job, but with a much more, you know, developmental focus on, it's not just putting kids in a room and, you know, keeping them safe. It's also about nurturing them and helping them grow and being sort of active learning focused. So I ended up meeting with him, and lo and behold, I found out in the meeting, his business partner is a friend of mine from college, Ben Newton. And, you know, Ben has dedicated his career to childhood development and, you know, worked for Teach for America. And we just both kind of laughed, like, what kismet and serendipity to have found each other sort of in this way. And, you know, we all agreed that it just seemed really wrong and sort of crazy that this entire segment of our population that dominate employment, I mean, healthcare and restaurants are the two top employers across the country, you know, by a huge landslide. And, you know, for those to be essentially systematically boxed out of traditional childcare in major cities, most particularly, you know, that is not okay. And we have to change that. And so we decided to partner up and work on a program that essentially would accommodate what hospitality, you know, employees and our teams need. So, you know, I know as things reopen, you know, Vivi will too, and they've been an incredible partner. And, you know, our goal is to hopefully roll out that program across the country. I think there's a massive, drastic need for it. And I think especially in this pandemic, we're feeling that and seeing that more starkly than ever.
Yeah, no, that's it's wonderful, really, that you not only saw that, but you took action. And I love the small world connections, for sure. That's always, you know, a silver lining in things when you reconnect with people and make things happen. So I'm you know, I give you a lot of credit for making that happen in the industry and spearheading it. So what's happening now? I mean, with COVID, and how I mean, when the pandemic initially hit, I mean, how did your team and restaurant react? You closed your doors. You know, what's transpired over the past couple of months?
Yeah, so March 15th, we closed our doors along with pretty much the rest of the country, and you know, our industry has been particularly devastated, right? I mean, it's actually illegal to work from home. You're not allowed to sell commercial food to the public from a residence. And, you know, it means with that, millions of people across the country. We employ 11 million people nationwide. We employ almost 1 million in New York alone. And it really all came to a screeching halt. And, you know, to date, unlike other industries, we are the only that has not received a single relief package for our industry specifically at any level of government. And we're 4 months in. Of the unemployment numbers, 1 in 4 people unemployed right now comes from the restaurant business. If those aren't signs that we need help, I don't know what is. And, you know, you're seeing massive closures. I think there's going to be another huge wave come the fall as, you know, some people's PPP funds burn out. And, you know, it's a very dark time. And it is, I think, a huge reckoning for this country to realize, you know, what an important role we play in our country, economically, socially, culturally. You know, I do think we are the heart of this nation in so many ways. And we're pushing very, very hard to get the relief that we need at all levels of government.
Yeah. I mean, your efforts with IRC and ROAR, I want to dive into more into that. Well, maybe we'll hold that a bit for the industry news, but, our industry is in trouble, and I know you've been fighting for it. I saw on your website, I think you're doing a Westbourne Annex now.
Yeah, so we remained closed for quite a while, the first 8 to 10 weeks. We actually did a work from home program with our team for the first 6 weeks. So we did remote trainings and classes, sort of turned into a remote school, which was pretty amazing. But unfortunately, as you know, the pandemic's continued, as you know, indoor dining was canceled in New York. Our space unfortunately also drew the short stick. You know, we don't have a lot of frontage, which means we don't have a lot of space for outdoor dining. We don't have a garden. Our sidewalk is too small. There is actually construction going on this whole month on our street for a water main break. You know, and our space is very small. It's only 1,000 square feet. So in a lot of ways, we just are, you know, physically, due to no fault of our own, pretty poorly positioned for being able to resume regular operations, you know, in a pandemic world. So currently, we pivoted to an annex concept. So our goal is a couple-fold. One is bringing sort of the pantry from our home to yours. So we have an amazing spice kit where you can recreate a lot of our house specialties and dishes. We've got a lot of sauces and condiments and preserves. Some snacks. We have an amazing popcorn duo that we're making in-house. We've got our Togarashi Chex Mix and granola that people love. And then we are also helping curate in partnership with Natura, essentially bringing the green market to your home. So you can pre-order. We've pre-selected sort of the best of peak season. You know, in our immediate neighborhood, there actually isn't a green market. The Union Square Green Market is quite a walk if you're, you know, at home by yourself, and right now they have obviously really long lines because they live in the capacity. So this is a way to bring our farmers and all the amazing produce that they've worked really hard on to your home. And alongside that, we've got all of our natural California wines from Martha Stewman to Scribe to Encanto and everything in between. We're doing really fun, happy hour type, you know, bottle bundles. We've got any sort of a wine shop that you can curate yourself. And then we're also selling all of our foods from our local brewery partners. So, you know, the goal is really to bring the spirit of Westbourne, connect you to our partners and suppliers and makers, and really bring the experience to your home.
Yeah, no, I think it's great you're doing that. Cause I mean, your provisions, like what you offer is awesome selection. Have you been able to keep, your staff, or you, I mean, where are you at with that?
Unfortunately, we are down to management only, as you know, so many are. Unfortunately, first and foremost, like I said, our space is just not conducive to coming back to operations safely just yet. It's a big concern for us. You know, like I said, we're a very small space, very cramped quarters, and the shape of it also doesn't help. So, you know, that's the most brutal part of this. You know, we're family, right? I mean, we call it family meal. We are a family, and it is brutally painful, you know, for so many of us in this industry to have to be, you know, down and not with our teams the way that we want to be.
Yeah, I know. Well, but you're making something work now, and I know you know, my tip was inspired by you as it being, you know, being an activist. So let's take a little break and we'll come back. We'll play my speed round and then we'll talk some industry news and about all the activism you've been doing. And then we'll also have my solo dining experience and the final question. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Camilla Marcus. She's the founder of Westbourne. She's also a founding member of the Independent Restaurant Coalition and a co-founder of ROAR, a coalition of New York City-based restaurateurs. It is time. I feel like someone's excited there. It's time for my speed round. They must know. So what this is I'm gonna name a couple things. You get to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla. So I give you choices.
All right.
Okay, so here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Both.
Wine, beer, mocktail, or champagne?
Ooh, that's so hard because that really just depends on the mood. I'm definitely more wine and cocktail, but I'm also very into the zero proof movement as things change. Gia is a new one. I'm going to give a small plug. They did a spritz window out of our Westbourne window when we were closed this past month. Amazing, powerful, and inspiring female founder, Melanie Nasserin. So check out Gia.
Cool. Will do. How about tasting menu or a la carte?
I think at the right kind of restaurant, certainly, you always go omakase if they're offering it. And even a la carte, honestly, my greater preference would be to just say to the chef, look, cook whatever you want and pick from the menu. I always love an adventure and I much prefer being in there.
Okay. Small plates or large plates?
Family style, which I guess you could make out of both. There's, I think trying the most on a menu, my team always laughs. If we eat out, we usually try and get one of everything. I'm definitely a try it all and share it all kind of person.
Yeah, that's the problem I have when I do solo dining is when I want one of everything. better to eat out with a team for those purposes for sure. Okay, communal table or chef's counter?
Ooh, these are hard because I really like both.
There's no right or wrong, but
I'm definitely communal table if we're with a group, but if it's just me and my husband, we love a good chef's counter. I mean, I would eat in the kitchen while helping cook on the line if I could.
Yeah, I hear you. Okay, tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Oh, that's a very loaded one. I'm going to say it's not that simple.
Fair. Okay. I have a few more.
I will say it's not that simple, but we do have a huge opportunity in this country to really change the perception of the value of a meal and an experience, what goes into it, what it costs, what it means to do it right and mindfully. And really thinking through the compensation structure to be much more equitable. And part of that is guest education and changing the culture around that. Like I said, even at Westbourne, if you look at our Yelp page, some of the biggest comments are, it's too expensive. We source independently from farms, right? And we take care of our people. And that just isn't going to result in a $4 footlong sub. Sorry.
This question in my game has always been, it's a standard one I give, and it's always gets people a bit stuck and a bit like it's hard. It's a hard one to answer.
You've seen, I'm from California, you see that the healthcare surcharge has been taken so positively. There are people and companies outside of the industry that work with carbon credits and things like that. So I do think, I think the answer is loaded and it's not that simple because the truth is, our public, our people, our country need to be comfortable paying the right value for something, and it's not about the cheapest. It should be about value and it should be, including full compensation. And it takes a big shift, I think, like I said, in sort of consumer education, consumer behavior.
Right. Okay. We'll do a few more. How about cooking on Instagram Live or having a conversation and interview also on Instagram Live? Because I've seen you do both and you're excellent at both of them.
You're very kind. I actually find all really nerve-wracking, so I'm usually sweating big time underneath it all. Most people don't believe me, but, you know, ask my husband. I mean, I like the cooking because I feel like usually there's a conversation within it, so you get to sort of have both. But it depends, you know, for the place and time. I think that, you know, there's nothing more intimate than cooking with someone, and I think it opens up a lot more, you know, vulnerability and engagement that's maybe different than when you're just having a chat. So, you know, I think people put their guard down when they're cooking something. So I think it leads to good candor.
Yeah. I've done some Instagram Live interviews too, and I know it's a challenging platform, for sure. So just with the quirkiness of it, but I haven't cooked on camera. I think I give you a lot of credit for doing that. I think it's hard to multitask in that way. Okay, how about hosting conferences on tech or hosting dinners and catered events?
Oh gosh, well that's loaded because obviously I love tech table. Frank is tech table once a year, so probably the latter, hosting events more because they're more frequent, not because they're any less fun. I just, if I could have a dinner party or a gathering or a conference every day, I definitely would. I am a total extrovert, and I love the magic of randomness that those gatherings bring.
Yeah, are you guys thinking about Tech Table for this year? Or do you have a plan for it, or an online?
We are.
Okay.
We are cooking something up.
Cool. Well, I look forward to hearing about it. And I had a feeling that may be the answer.
Been an amazing supporter from day one. We are, trust me, so grateful. I remember the first one, and I remember you there.
Aw, thanks. Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful conference that you put together. So I look forward to seeing how you pivot with it now. It's been, you know, watching what other people are doing with different conferences and festivals. You know, it's been challenging. So we'll stay tuned for that. Okay, my last two are cheese plate or dessert.
Oh, dessert. All the way.
All the way. And Manhattan, Brooklyn, or Los Angeles?
I was actually going to say my secret talent is pastry, and I have such an admiration for pastry cooks, and I know that it's been in particular hard for that community so much. So shout out to all those pastry chefs. It is hard work, often the unsung heroes of kitchens, so I never miss dessert.
Okay. I love it. My last one is Manhattan, Brooklyn, or Los Angeles.
Oh, gosh. I mean, L.A. will always be home. That's my heart. But, you know, I love to travel. So there's many places and cities around the world that speak to me. But, you know, everything even about Westbourne is so much about Los Angeles. So if I had to rank, I got to choose it.
Okay. I know that I figured that would be a hard one to answer too, but it's just a game. Okay, so for industry news, I figured we could dive in more to what you've been working on behalf of the whole hospitality restaurant industry, which is, you know, I've been following along, and it's tremendous. I mean, you're not only a founder of Roar for New York restaurants, but you've been very involved in the IRC, the Independent Restaurant Coalition. So you want to talk a little bit about how they came about and like what's progressed over the past, you know, through this time period of uncertainty?
I think this is the first time that, you know, all restaurateurs and chefs across the country have really become so hands-on and politically active. And I think first and foremost, we have the time and we're home, you know, not in service, which makes it very hard. But two, you know, like I said, we've been hit so tremendously hard and so devastated, and looks like we will be, you know, the hardest and longest hit through this. And, you know, it's really high time. I think that the pandemic really just triggered what was already brewing, which is, you know, we need to restructure as an industry. We need government assistance at all levels to do that. And, you know, we're not okay being ignored anymore. You know, I think now what has changed is we're here to stay. And I think that now Washington and state and city governments see us for what we are, which is the largest employer across the country. And, you know, having such a massive supply chain on top of that, and businesses that reinvest, you know, over 90% of profits and sales go back into our communities, into other businesses, and into our teams. And we've never really been, you know, considered as such, unfortunately. And I think what we're seeing over these last 3 months of us being pretty much ignored while we're being so heavily devastated, you know, just has got to stop. And, you know, hopefully we'll change that tide and that relationship going forward in a big structural way. So, you know, I encourage everyone to go to www.saverestaurants.com. We have the Restaurants Act. I know it seems frustrating when people say, call and email your representatives, but it really is that simple, and it is really that critical. The 11 million people in our industry depend on that. So we have an automated emailer. It literally takes 2 seconds. If you and 10 friends, and they got 10 friends, and you committed to doing it every single day for the next few weeks, you would see a change. It is high time that we received, like I said, industry-specific aid, given just how disproportionately we've been affected by this.
Yeah, well, you sort of answered the question I have for my last guest, which I have for you. On episode 257, I had on Digby Stritteron. He is the chef at Brada, Ama, and Breaker's Roar in St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands. And he wanted to know, in respect to everything that's going on right now, what is the best way for me to go to my congressman or woman and ask for change? What is the best route? Is it sending a letter or making a call and following up? And he said he'd greatly appreciate any advice.
If you go to the IRC website, again, www.saverestaurants.com, it's so simple. We've made it an automated email. Literally just put your name and your zip code in. It takes 2 seconds. Like I said, if every person did that across the country for just the next couple weeks, every single day, for 2 minutes of your day, you would see a change. We're asking for $120 billion for our industry. You know, we are... I understand individually we are small businesses, but collectively we are not a small business. And it's
high time. Yeah, no, it's great. I feel you guys, I mean, there's been, you know, with PPP and I feel there's been progress, you know, and having a seat at the White House. I know there's so much more that needs to be done to help save restaurants. And, I love how the community of our industry came together and is fighting together to help everyone, because we are all in this. And I just want to say thank you for that, and to anyone listening to the show, like, yes, like, do what you can, reach out to your congressman and help us. Help us get through this.
If ever, you know, I keep reminding people that, you know, it's hard. We're used to performing. We're used to making you forget your problems. We're used to taking care of you and making you feel that the world is all right. It's very not in our nature to ask for help and to show the cracks. But this is that time, and if not now, when? This is the time, you know, to give back to your favorite restaurant who, you know, took care of you on a bad day, who made your anniversary special, who helped you celebrate your birthday. This is the time. 2 minutes a day, I think it's, you know, we're the first to help as well. You know, we were the first industry next to frontline workers. You know, we've fed frontline workers. We've been helping relief efforts. We've been the first to jump to and the first, you know, the first that people turn to for help, security, food, and assistance.
Yes.
And now we're asking for help.
Let's get through this. So it's time for my solo dining experience. And this is not a typical one, but then again, it's not a very typical time. So it was very memorable. So this is why I'm sharing it. So this week it's at Pico Oysters. Here's the rundown. The location, 900 First Street, New Suffolk, North Fork, Long Island, New York. The concept, turning water into brine. The owner, farmer and avid fisherman, Peter Stein, who founded Pico Oysters in 2016, farmed in Little Peconic Bay. Pico's are the only oysters based out of the area. So why did I go? Well, I was out in North Fork for a couple days and I picked up on this place on social media. I saw on Tom Colicchio's Instagram feed that he posted about it. And so I was like, let me check this out. So my experience, well, I went on my last day when out in North Fork when I was going to be heading back to Manhattan, and I didn't think they shucked the oysters there. I think it was a place you just took them and you had to shuck them yourself. But I was up for it, and I stopped by, and it was raining out. It was, you know, there was a storm coming. I was trying to get out of North Fork before the storm. But I pulled up. There's an open garage. There was a super nice worker in there, and I told him I wanted to get a dozen oysters to go and was going to, shuck them when I got back home. And he was concerned about packing them in ice and the ice melting and ruining the oysters. So I went with the plan B, which was I got a half dozen and I got a shucking knife. And I took them to the beach nearby, and I literally shucked these oysters in my car by the beach because it was raining. And he gave me a little towel too, because I knew I needed a towel. And I don't shuck that much, but I knew I was up for the challenge. Anyways, I had this awesome car picnic, and he gave me an extra, oyster. So I had seven oysters. I got them all opened. I slurped them down. No lemon, no nothing, but they were so fresh and delicious. It was one of my favorite experiences. And I kept the shells too. When I got home, I washed them, figure out, I don't know what I'm going to do with them, but I have them. So my take is, this place is awesome. The delicious oysters, they're called Pico's. And they were so fresh. There was no smell. There was, they were delicious. So I highly recommend, the ambiance. It was my rental car in a parking lot by the beach in North Fork, perfect for oyster lovers. Interesting tidbit, Pico Oysters supplies oysters to a lot of top New York City restaurants, including Le Bernardin, Gramercy Tavern, 11 Madison Park, and Kraft. And I also saw on social media after just a few days ago that Tom Colicchio did a virtual oyster event with them as well. So personal fun fact, actually, the last time I shucked oysters was on Fire Island a couple years ago when I was out there in a house share, and I had volunteered to do it. I was out there with my friend Marissa Lippert, who was on episode 256, and she was doing most of the cooking, and I was glad I could contribute to shucking oysters, even though I have to say I would not hire me to do this. I can get them open, but I wouldn't say it's that gracefully. The cost was $20. It was $5 for the oysters and $15 for the shucking knife. Really good deal on those oysters. And would I go back? Of course. Their website is picooysters.com. That's P-E-E-K-O oysters.com. So there you go, Camilla. Have you heard of this place?
I have heard of it. I haven't been yet. And I did watch Tom's episode event with them. It was amazing. I mean, never met an oyster I didn't love. It kind of reminds me the way you described that. The Marshall store is an amazing place outside of San Francisco. And I had a very similar experience. So I was laughing, listening to you, thinking, man, that was deja vu on the other coast.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's actually like a garage, or it's their farm, but there's no glam there. This is just, they're this serious oyster people. it was awesome. I would do it again. And now I had a knife at home, but now I have a second one. So I'm ready to shuck. Okay. So it's time for the final question. My next guest is Gary Obligation. I always never sure if that's the correct way to pronounce his last name. He's before told me to call him Gary O. I'll get it next week, right? So sorry, Gary. But Gary is the general manager at Post Ranch Inn in Big Sur, California, and he's formerly the director of service operations at the Alinea Group. So Camilla, what would you like to ask Gary?
Well, first off, I want to say hi, Gary. I adore Gary. I met him actually while he was working at the Alinea Group and made for truly one of the most spectacular dining experiences, a magical evening in Chicago that I will never soon forget. And I just adore him. And I actually just recently saw that he went over to Post Ranch Inn, which also holds a lot of really special memories and is just a place from a fairy tale book. I want him to share a little bit with, you know, those who may not be familiar and talk a little bit more about what they did when the pandemic hit, because I believe I read somewhere that they had a number of guests that were essentially, I mean, I hate to say stuck at Post Ranch Inn, because that just doesn't seem like the right word to be stuck in heaven. But they were there for quite some time at the lockdown. And I heard some amazing, you know, what we used to call hospitality hero moments. No doubt imagined by Gary, who is just one in a million. So I want him to tell the audience about those, you know, it's always silver linings if, as long as we're open and have our eyes looking for them.
Awesome. Yeah, he's good people. I'm really excited to talk to him. I definitely will. And I've never been to Post Ranch Inn, but it looks so gorgeous. I'm like, what a great place to work. And I hope to get out there one day.
Yeah, we had a friend get married right by there a number of years ago. And I said, we are driving and we are staying just one night just to enjoy the magic. It is just there. It's such a perfect fit too, because Gary's really just such a special soul, as such a creative and, you know, so over the top. And he just goes that extra mile and beyond, just the kind of heartfelt and extraordinary hospitality that you would expect there. And I know he's going to take them to, you know, new soaring heights. That's very special.
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. I will ask and send him your regards for sure. And, that's the show. I so appreciate you taking the time to come on my show and talk with me. And I just want to congratulate you for all your efforts and everything you're doing on behalf of the hospitality industry. I've been following along. I've watched many interviews with you. I've read articles. I know you've written for Food and Wine. I mean, you're so active and you're such an amazing voice for our industry. And I wish you the best. And with Westbourne, Just all the best to you, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sherry, for having me. This was really a true pleasure.
Oh, you're very welcome. So my guest today has been Camilla Marcus. She's the founder of Westbourne Cafe in Manhattan, Soho. She's also a founding member of the Independent Restaurant Coalition and a co-founder of Roar. Her website's westbourne.com, and that's WESTBOURNE.com, SaveRestaurants.com, and RoarNewYork.org. You can follow social media, hashtag SaveRestaurants, at hashtag Too Small to Fail, and some handles also to follow. You got at Camilla.Marcus, at Westbourne, at Roar.NY, at INDP Restaurants, and at Tech Table Summit. I got them all there. And you can follow me at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR and at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My websites are BayerPublicRelations.com, SherryBayer.com, and AllInTheIndustry.com. All of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are also in iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks to my engineer today, Amanda Wang, and thanks again to Camilla. I'm Sherry Bayer. I'll be back next week with another show. I hope you'll tune in then. Be safe. Be well, and thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. I'm Sherry Bayer, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.